I would like to describe some work on Ginsberg-Landau that has been ongoing with Alberto Montero, who's going to speak a little bit later today, and Bob Girard, and related to some earlier work with Bill Ziemer. So I'm using, let me write down the Ginsberg-Landau functional here. I'm using essentially the same non-dimensionalization that Patty just had on the board here, but slight difference. So I'm going to recall a G epsilon here. This is a functional that depends on an order parameter and a magnetic potential. So the way I'm going to write it is as follows. Integral over a domain omega, I'll describe in a minute. This is going to be an R3 of grad minus IA psi squared, say 1/2, 1 over 4 epsilon squared, and the potential term psi squared minus 1 squared, and then an integral over R3 of 1/2 curl of A minus some applied field, which one could take to be scaled with epsilon. I'll describe what epsilon is in a minute, but I'll write H applied epsilon squared. Okay. So before I tell you what I want to do with this, so this is a setting with where we're modeling a superconductor with an order parameter that's complex valued. It's modulus, or really the modulus squared is giving the density of the superconducting electron. And A is a magnetic potential corresponding to the effective field. So this will be a map from R3 to R3. Likewise with H applied. Now, in the formulation Patty had on the board, there was a cap of the Ginsberg-Landau parameter. That's become 1 over epsilon. So, or 1 over epsilon is the Ginsberg-Landau parameter, which is, as you might guess from my notation, is going to be, the epsilon is going to be taken to be small, the parameter is going to be taken to be large. So this is a relevant to so-called type 2 superconductors. And one point here, remember there was in the formulation Patty had on the board, there was a 1 over kappa here. So you know, you can imagine pulling that out, and okay, that you can get yourself a 1 over epsilon squared here, but there should be some appearance over here. This is not a crucial point, but I just want to mention that this is really a formulation corresponding to small fields. And in this scaling, these quantities are not going to be large. Okay, so some of you are very familiar with this, others maybe not so much, but what interests me in studying the Ginsberg-Landau energy is really understanding the singular structures that appear, that is the vortices. So by a vortex I mean the set where the order parameter vanishes, and understanding how how the field looks and what is its relation to the location of the vortices, et cetera. In particular, I'm interested in the presence of local minimizers to this energy. Maybe the easiest case to think about for what I'm going to describe, and also I think the most interesting one actually in terms of our results, would be the case of no applied field. When you have an applied field, it's kind of well known both experimentally and analytically that you generate vortices. They're going to, if H applied is very big, there'll be a very large zero set. And if I'm taking three dimensions here, so generically these are going to be codimension 2 objects, all sorts of curves running through our domain. But if you have no applied field, it's not clear why there should be a vortex. Why would a vortex want to live in such an environment? In particular, let me point out, if there's no applied field, the global minimizer is just taking psi to be zero and psi to be any constant unit vector and A to be zero. So it's not even obvious that there are other critical points around. There turn out to be other critical points, but in particular, it's not clear at all that there should be other stable critical points besides the global minimizer. Okay, and again, since going back to my comment about scaling, since I'm really thinking about a situation here, having written it this way, where the fields are small, one wants to think about when would there be or why would there be vortex solutions in this setting. Okay. This problem or this energy has been studied extensively. In particular, a real guide to kind of understanding what kind of results one might establish and what kind of tools one might use comes from looking at a kind of a reduced version of this, reduced energy, which many people also refer to as a Ginsburg-Landau energy. Let me distinguish them by, I'll call this one E epsilon. But for me, E epsilon, say, of psi would be the energy you get from taking no applied field and taking no A. So you just get just the 1/2 grad psi squared plus 1 over epsilon squared, or 1 over 4 epsilon squared if you want your factors of 2 to work out right, times psi squared minus 1 squared. Okay. So, again, a lot of the tools that have been successful over the last few years in analyzing this problem were first developed on the reduced energy, and that will be the case in the approach I'm going to describe today as well. In particular, I should say that the question of whether there exist stable critical points or non-existence result for stable critical points, there's a strong parallel here. In fact, I don't know of any settings in which, for example, you have a certain type of stable critical point, say, for the reduced energy, but there isn't a counterpart here. I mean, in some cases, there's a theorem proven here, and there isn't a theorem yet there, but even there, one strongly suspects there is a connection. So these two are closely linked. Okay. All right, so again, let me now start to describe what the result is like, but the issue is, the question is, can one find stable vortex solutions, by solutions I mean critical points, for this G epsilon, and so let me put in here at least for certain samples omega. So omega being the region occupied by the superconductor. And in particular, the issue is when there's either zero or very small applied field, can you do this? All right. So let me give you a little motivation for our approach. So again, suppose let's say psi epsilon, we really would think of this as a sequence, is a good set or a good competitor in some kind of minimization. Suppose you were building a sequence that you thought would have a vortex, so a good competitor, I should say, with vortices, with a zero set that's non-trivial. Okay. So let's just very kind of very formally here, let's suppose we evaluate the energy. And again, let's, for example, in terms of these heuristics here, let's take, just to keep things simple, let's take no applied field. So you might then, build some sequence of functions that vanish, say, along some curve or set of curves. Pair that off with zero as a rough approximation. So again, in that case, with no applied field and with no, A is a magnetic potential here. Maybe I should have said that. The curl of A
I think I failed to mention that. The curl of A is then the effective field. So A is a magnetic potential.
Okay. So then this is just the same as E. Remember, now we're in some three-dimensional domain, so there's some blob here. We have some curve or set of curves. Maybe they start on the boundary and end on the boundary. Maybe there's some closed loop in here in the interior of the domain where these are supposed to be the zero sets. This is where psi is zero. Okay, but if you carry out some kind of construction like this, you can quickly convince yourself, first of all, that if good means that the energy isn't too high, given that middle term there, you better make sure the order parameter has modulus 1 pretty quickly. I mean, here it's 0, but in, away from some core that has to be, say, of order epsilon, out here, for example, the modulus should be nearly 1. And then you can do a calculation and convince yourself that the energy really, once you kind of have a good construction along some cross-section here, why not just stick with that? And so if you do take that kind of a philosophy, what you're going to get is some cost per unit length of a vortex. I'll just call it C. There's some, because that'd be some multiple of pi. You also find that in terms of epsilon, the best you're going to do if it vanishes is something on the order of log epsilon. And then this will simply multiply the length of the vortex. And in this talk, I'm going to use the letter capital gamma for the zero set for the vortex, so length of gamma. So these curves here are various pieces, let's say, of gamma. Okay. So very rough heuristics here. This would literally be, you could literally be the case if you had a straight vortex, say a line segment, where you could just do kind of a 2D construction and then extend it to be trivial in the third direction. Okay. All right. So the approach I want to describe to you is based on this kind of heuristic that says, look, the energy of a good competitor is, well, first of all, okay, you're not going to do better than a logarithm. That's kind of irrelevant. This constant, something universal. How could you find a local minimizer? Well, given this kind of asymptotic connection, you might look for a vortex that locally, at least, minimizes length. And then the idea would be if there's a local minimizer of length, that might be the zero set of a local minimizer of the Ginsburg-Landau energy. That's the basis for the approach I want to describe to you. So it's just this idea that asymptotically, Ginsburg-Landau energy is like length of the vortex. The ends are not expensive. That's a lower order. Formally you can argue they're going to come in normally, but that's not a big cost here. It's lower order than a log. Okay. Now, when I say want a local minimizer of length, I'm getting back to this point. I want to find domains that have this property, that there is some kind of curve within them that is shorter than anybody else nearby it. Of course, I have to describe to you what nearby means and et cetera, and even how we're measuring length, because another point I haven't gotten to it, I want to come back more later, is that these vortices could, typically the order parameter is winding around them. If you looked at some 2D slice, you could talk about a winding number, and you might imagine looking for local minimizers with a winding number not just of 1, but of 23 or something. So in addition to the length of the curve, you have to somehow in measuring, besides its actual arc length, you have to kind of attach a number corresponding to a winding number. I'll get to that. Okay, but that's the idea thing. Now, let me mention, this idea of this asymptotic connection between Ginsburg-Landau and length goes back to many authors, many of whom are in the room now, so at the risk of, or at the certainty of insulting somebody by forgetting their name, let me mention some of the people who have explored this asymptotic, let me just say asymptotic connection between Ginsburg-Landau and length of vortices. There are a lot of people who have contributed. I'm thinking specifically in pretty much with this list, with people who've worked on this in three dimensions. But so certainly Tristan Rivière has done a lot of work in this, and Lin, Fanhua Lin, in collaboration with Rivière, Giovanni Alberti with Baldo and Orlandi have studied this connection. Batuel and Brazis and Orlandi have worked on this. Etienne Sandier, Sylvia Serfati, there's recent work, well, actually not so recent, but I just learned about it, by Brazis, Bourguin, and Mironescu. And what was most influential for me, work of Bob Girard and Mette Soner. Okay, so there's bound to be somebody in this room I've insulted just now, but so I apologize in advance. These are some of the people who have studied this connection. A lot of this work was in the context of looking at the reduced energy. Let me now turn to actually borrowing some of the tools that others have developed to carrying out this program. Again, the idea is to kind of a direct method to try to minimize, actually I should be pointing here, minimize the Ginzburg-Landau energy amongst competitors that are close in some sense or whose vortices are close to some local minimizer of length. All right. So there are some key tools here. A lot of it comes from geometric measure theory, so I just want to spend a couple minutes talking about some of the tools. So key tools. We're going to bring to bear a theory of currents and of weak Jacobians. Let me start with currents, and all one needs to know kind of for this context. So in order to make this connection, you know, rather than thinking of vortices as a bunch of curves, I mean, there's a geometric measure theoretic notion of a curve, a one current, and that's what we're going to use here. So let me describe to you that first of all. So we're going to view vortices, these are vortices, of course, in R3, as a one current. For those who haven't worked with this stuff, just a bounded linear functional acting on one forms, but we're going to view them as a particular kind of current. We're going to view these as rectifiable currents. For anybody who may be sinking in their seat, thinking, oh God, here comes a one-hour lecture on geometric measure theory, this is going to be very, very sketchy, so probably not helpful at all, actually. But okay. But let's think of it this way. We're going to start with, say, let's think of it as some collection of Lipschitz curves. And I guess the ones, without being real precise, the ones I really want to consider would be any of these two types. Endpoints on the boundary of the domain, or perhaps closed loops here. But in general, one can associate with that a so-called rectifiable current, something that eats a one form, in the following way. I'll use this notation. So T sub gamma, and it's going to act on a one form just through integration. So we're going to integrate over this set. And now here comes this I mentioned a while ago that there's kind of a winding number you could associate with this Lipschitz curve. So let's fix an integer, say a positive integer m. Actually, could be just integer valued, but let's keep life simple here. So we're going to integrate m. And then again, this is just a one form. See, we're just going to integrate it against, just pair it off with a tangent vector to this Lipschitz curve. So this is say, d arc length, or d one-dimensional Hausdorff measure. So tau here is just a tangent vector, tangent to gamma. Okay, so this is, and again, C is a one form. All right, so this is just what I'm writing down here are tools that have been developed by various people, a language for making the connection between this energy, particularly the zero sets of the order parameter, and some configuration of curves. So given a curve, okay, we can think of it as acting on a one form through integration. We refer to M in this case as the multiplicity, and let me just introduce this notation so I don't ever have to write this again. Say R1 of omega will be the integer multiplicity, meaning M is an integer. Integer multiplicity, rectifiable one current. Okay. Fine. So that's how we're going to think of vortices. One other comment to make here. When we talk about measuring their length, I mean, I'm going to look for vortices that are locally minimal. How do we measure the length? Well, just the length of gamma, but weighted with M. So the mass of T just the soup of T gamma acting on one form of modulus less equal to one, you're just going to get really just the multiplicity times the length, let's say the one measure of gamma. In particular, if you want to just think about multiplicity one, then it's just the length of gamma. Okay, now, that's how we're going to kind of think of competing vortices. Now, how do we talk about competitors in some variational problem, in some direct method, let's say, being close to a particular curve or one current? Closeness is going to be measured through their Jacobian. So let me, again, give a one-board discussion of weak Jacobians. So we have maps here that this is, I'm talking about the order parameter now, from omega, say some three-dimensional domain into the complex plane, which for this discussion you might want to think of as associated with a map from R3 to R2, let's say. Okay, so we have our classical Jacobian would just be, you know, we wrote just, took D psi, wrote down the gradient, you get a 2x3 matrix, right? And if you took each of the 2x2 minors, you get a vector. And that's kind of the calculus Jacobian, that vector with those three minors as its components. And now, there's a way of kind of describing that in a weaker sense, thinking of it really as a current, and that's the formalism I want to describe to you. But I want to emphasize before I jump into this, it is just a formalism. If you just want to think of it as, for smooth maps, you could just think of the Jacobian as just that three vector I just mentioned. Okay, but here's the formalism that allows one to make this connection between Ginsburg-Landau and these objects. So let's start like this. You could think of I'll use J here. J psi, this Jacobian, rather than thinking of it as a vector, let's think of it as a two form, for reasons you'll see in a minute. So you could think of it as the pullback by psi of dy. This would be just the volume element in R2. So if psi had component functions psi 1 and psi 2, I'm just saying d psi 1, d psi 2. These are the component functions. Or just the object you integrate in order to get the area of the image map. Okay. Now, what I'm trying to do is to kind of manipulate this around so that I can compare these objects with those objects. And therefore, I want to think of it as something that eats a one form. All right. Well, if you've got a two form, the easiest thing to do is to integrate it against a one form. That makes that sensible then. So so in that way, you can talk about a Jacobian as something that eats one forms. Couple ways to say it. So let me put a star here. I'll call this star J. psi. This is going to be a one current defined as j psi integrate against phi over omega. Okay. Now, here's the, so far, you might say, well, what, this doesn't particularly seem to be a weak formulation, but here's one important observation. This j psi turns out to be a curl of something else. So it is 1/2 d little j of psi, where little j is defined to be 1 over 2i. Let me go back to a complex description here. Psi, deep psi star, star is conjugation, or sorry, psi star deep psi minus psi deep psi star. Okay. So putting it, again, in terms of just standard calculus, if you think of this as a vector, if you take its curl, you get the standard Jacobian. Does what depend? This identity? Or? No. No, this is just a, no. Uh-uh. It's just a, take some derivatives. But if you, exploiting this, you can do an integration by parts and get, I think I may have left out a factor of a half here. All right. Anyway, and take the following thing, get J integrated against d psi, d phi, excuse me. So here's a two form now, here's a one form. And the point is now, the only reason I write this down is just to point out to you that this definition is sensible. Let's see, when can you do this kind of integration? I mean, phi is something smooth, right? But this would make sense, for instance, if psi were bounded, and if its derivative were integrable. So say W11 functions. And so in that sense, you get kind of a weak, you can extend the notion of a Jacobian to this weaker setting. I mean, if you're willing to take W12 functions, then if, you know, you can write out the whole Jacobian and see that it's a nice integrable quantity. But this allows you to extend it a little bit. Okay. All right. This, now, so this is, I mean, this kind of description of the Jacobian is been described by many people, in particular, you know, the work of Girard and Sona, the work of Alberti, Baldo, and Orlandi, use this language to make a connection in terms of gamma convergence between Ginzburg-Landau and lengths, and lengths of vortices. All right. I'm not going to probably have time to quote the precise theorems that these people have written down, but actually, if you want to hear about it later today, Alberto Montero is going to describe a little bit more of the details of the proof. I just want to really get to the statement of the result and describe, make some remarks about that. Okay, so now we're ready to talk about what kind of a domain would admit a local minimizer of length. Those are the candidates for domains that would admit local minimizers for Ginzburg-Landau. So domains omega admitting local minimizers. Now, so I say of length, let me put it in quotes now that I've dragged you through all this, because now what I really mean by length is mass. There could be a multiplicity in there too, but if the multiplicity is one, I'm just talking about length. All right, so you can maybe picture what might do the trick. I mean, a closed loop would never do, right? You could always just contract it. You could find something nearby. I haven't said anything about topologies, but whatever topology I might throw to you, presumably if you take it a little bit smaller, it's going to have less mass, less length. So we're really talking about something with endpoints that begin and end on the boundary, and I think the obvious candidate would be a domain that's shaped like an apple, let's say. An apple shaped domain. Okay. Something like this. So, here's another color. So, gamma, that is the vortex that I have in mind, would be this line segment that goes right down the core. All right. So, if you want, you could attach a winding number to it, but one would find it believable, whatever the topology is I'm setting it, that this would represent a local minimizer of length. Now, the more precise assumption we make is that we assume there's a line segment inside the domain with the property that if you draw some sufficiently thin cylinder about it, the following is true. We assume that, so for us, apple-shaped means there exists a cylinder, maybe very thin, that lies entirely inside the open set, except it touches the boundary at these two points. One can weaken that a little bit. I won't get into it, but that's the basic assumption. If you want to assume the domain is smooth, rather than just say Lipschitz, then you could, for example, a sufficient condition would be that the line segment meets normally and that the curvatures, let's say, have the right sign, but you don't need that. We could have curvatures vanishing to infinite order. That's not really the issue here, just that the local minimizer of length. So that's going to be a domain for which we're going to get local minimizers. Now, perhaps more fun is to think about more complicated vortex structures. So there could be many of these. So to stick with the fruit analogy, one that at least I've experienced, I don't know if you've ever done this, but I often bring fruit to my office to work while I'm working to have a snack, and I almost as frequently forget that I brought it in. And sometimes, usually through some scent, that odor that comes up, I kind of remember, oh yeah, I brought an apple last week. And I dig under the papers and there it is. So you might think of, let's say, an abandoned apple. So now it looks more like this. Depending on how many days it's been sitting there. But you can imagine a number of these line segments. So this is supposed to be in 3D, remember. So these guys are not, I'm not going to allow them to bump into each other, but each one locally minimizes length in the sense that there's one of these cylinders that you can draw around it. Some configuration like that. So again, I'll refer to this whole thing as gamma. There could be N of these different guys, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3. There could be winding numbers associated with each one, M1, M2, M3. Multiplicities, I should say. And that whole thing I think of as gamma, that one current. And again, I write down a theorem now, but the statement is basically going to be that you can find a local minimizer of the Ginzburg-Landau energy with an order parameter asymptotically, let's say, vanishing along these line segments and winding in some weak sense, having winding number given by these integers arbitrarily selected. Okay. Maybe I should make a comment here before I write down the theorem. You know, when you're modeling some problem like this, you could have a situation like, say, in Giovanni Alberti's talk today, where there are certain structures that are physically observed. You have a model, and the question is, well, can that model predict all these structures? Can you understand the structures through the model? This result I would cast in a different vein. Here, to my knowledge, people have not physically observed these kinds of structures. So the issue would be whether, you know, one could use a model to perhaps predict behavior that, you know, in an ideal world. I don't know if it'll happen. Maybe if an experimentalist might then look for these kinds of solutions in the laboratory. So I'll get comment more about that in a minute. But these kinds of vortex solutions, to my knowledge at least, have not been observed. I'll tell you what kinds of solutions have been seen in a moment. Okay, so here's the result. So again, this is work. This is the result of Bob Girard, Alberto Montero, and me. So we assume, let me just say, assume omega admits a local minimizer of mass, I have to backtrack a minute here, let's say gamma, well, not backtrack, but I really need to, if I'm going to state a theorem, give you a topology now. So in what sense is it a local minimizer? A local minimizer of mass, like gamma, think in terms of these pictures over here. So in the sense that I just realized that. A local minimizer of mass, say T gamma, in a sense that the mass of T gamma is strictly less than the mass of T for all the integer multiplicity one currents T that are close in the following sense. For all T such that the distance between T gamma and T and the dual of the Lipschitz norm, C01 dual, and I have to actually put in a notation here, a T I'll describe in a minute, is less than or equal to, say, some delta. This is for some positive delta. Okay, so just a word about this. So this notation means the one forms we're considering, looking at these guys with that. This notation means that they, on the boundary, they're purely normal. Either they vanish on the boundary or they're purely normal, but they don't have a tangential part. Okay, and again, I probably won't be able to comment on that, but perhaps Alberto Montero will talk a little bit about why that comes in. Now, of course, if you haven't seen this stuff before, this is a bizarre norm to be working with. But those are the cards one is dealt. That is a topology in which one can make the asymptotic connection between Ginzburg-Landau and length. So that's what you got to work with here. Okay. So we assume this, we have this situation. And again, I want to stress when I talk about T gamma, I'm assigning integers arbitrarily. You can choose any numbers, any integers you want here to correspond to the winding numbers. So then the statement is there exists some epsilon naught positive such that for all epsilon less than epsilon naught, there exists a local minimizer. It's really a local minimizing pair, a local minimizer psi epsilon A epsilon of G epsilon. Okay, so let's see. How much time do I have? 8 minutes, okay. So let me reuse my remaining 8 minutes to talk about, I'm not going to talk about the proof, but just talk about you want to know a lot of stuff. Huh? So I maybe not very wisely, but I wanted to describe that in a list of remarks. So that should be part of the theorem. I agree. But instead, you'll get it as a remark. So I will make the connection between that and gamma. So, okay, let me start with that one then. Let's go over here. So there are two senses in which one can make the connection, at least so far that we've made the connection. One is, one can prove that these Jacobians of these psi epsilons converge, again, in this topology, this dual of C01, converge, actually there's a factor of pi, so pi times T gamma. This is in this C01 dual topology. So the Jacobians are behaving in the limit as this rectifiable current does, that supports on them. One can also prove the following statement, that in terms of kind of closeness, that for every delta, oh, this is a different delta. All right, different delta than that one. How about delta 1? For every delta 1, there exists a number epsilon 1 such that the following is true. Let me get this right, that the set gamma is contained in the set of x's in omega whose distance from, say, the set where the order parameter is less than a half, which is going to be a very thin set, is less than delta 1. In other words, one can prove, remember that mod psi is going to 1 most of the time. So this is kind of a fattened neighborhood of the vortex, and this guy will live inside it. So like it's kind of half of Hausdorff convergence between these two objects, the vortex and the zero set. Okay. All right. So that's the sense that's the connection that one can make between the vortices of these local minimizers and this object, this, if you like, this array of line segments that we begin with. Question. This is, okay, thank you. I left out a hypothesis. Okay, this is under an assumption that the applied field isn't too big. So, assume that the integral over omega of the applied field, which again could be depending on epsilon, is little o of log squared. Sounds like it could be kind of big, but remember my comment at the beginning. In this scaling, this really turned out not to be very big fields. Okay. All right. So that's that. Let me, there are a number of comments I wanted to make, and most of which I won't get to, but let me do a few. I should say that there are, in terms of the full Ginzburg-Landau energy, there is one other result I know of showing stable vortex solutions with, say, with zero applied field. So I wanted to mention some other related existence results very briefly here. So there's work of Jimbo and Zai with H applied zero. And with omega, basically a perturbation of a non-simply connected domain. So what they do is, for example, I'll just draw one example of it. Take a domain such as this. Take a solid of revolution that looks like that, where this is very thin, and they argue if it's thin enough, they can find local minimizers. Again, the issue here is simple connectivity. That's why I mentioned a minute ago that you know, in terms of the physics literature, the getting vortex solutions without an applied field is what's called, or such a solution is called a permanent current. Kind of mysterious thing, but one of the most famous phenomena in superconductivity. You induce a current, then maybe you shut off whatever mechanism you had turned on to get that current going, no applied field, and this current, you know, spins around indefinitely. You know, they make measurements and estimate that it would take, you know, whatever, millions of years for this thing to stop. But in all the experiments I've seen, in all the literature I've seen, it's always a ring-shaped domain, a domain with holes in it, non-simply connected. And so what we're finding here is that at least Ginzburg-Landau says you don't need a hole. You need a dent. You need an apple. Okay. And that perhaps there could be these kinds of currents. But so this is an extreme case of that in the Jimbo-Zai result, very different techniques. In terms of local minimizers in the same spirit for E epsilon, that when I say in the same spirit, I mean exploiting the connection between length and Ginzburg-Landau, there's work by Jimbo and Morita. There's work by Delpino, Selmer, and Kowalczyk. And by Montero and Bill Ziemer and myself, it was really kind of a generalization of that led us to this result for E epsilon. Okay, do I have any time left? No, 3 minutes. Oh, good. Okay. No. Oh. Okay. I don't. All right then. All right. Can't tell you all these jokes. Okay. Let's see, what's my best remark I still have left?
Is your apple always simply connected?
Yeah, for our theorem, we required simple connectivity. Yeah. But when I say, maybe that's, so let me not make any of these remarks, but let me just say that the assumption is a purely local one, though. I mean, this is supposed to look like an apple near the core, but it can look like a pineapple or I don't know what out here. I don't care what happens out there. These are just local hypotheses there. Okay, I guess, let me just finish by saying that in the case, last comment, if we take H applied independent of epsilon, and we write the effective field as the effective potential, the guy whose curl is H applied, plus whatever is induced. Let's call it A epsilon induced. Then we can also describe asymptotically the limit of A, the A epsilon induced. Let's say that we can, if I denote by H0, the limit of the curl of the induced potential, that is, H0 is a limit of the induced field, then one finds it satisfies the following equation, Laplace, minus Laplacian H0, at least in the right gauge, plus H0 plus H applied equals some factor, I won't try to get it right, pi times this T gamma. Think of this as, say, now I'm thinking this more as a measure now. It's really a delta function supported on these line segments. So you get, those of you who work in this business will see this as kind of a London-type equation in the limit. So I've been, for lack of time, I'm not getting into topologies here, but we can characterize the limit of the induced field and say that it satisfies a kind of a three-dimensional London-type equation in the limit. Okay, let me finish with that.